Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
Ooh, that was unexpected.
So, once again, we're here to talk about a film in probably tedious detail, but hopefully we'll at least make it somewhat listenable. I'm Richard Nicholas, and with me is Abigail Bain.
Hello.
And Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
So, guys, this week's pick was Abby's, and it is The Wrestler from, I want to say 2012, but I could be wrong.
2007, I think.
Jesus.
Okay, according to IMDb, it's 2008.
Oh. I would have my second guess would have been 9, so obviously no idea. Abby.
Are you guessing?
Yeah, why guess when Abby has the details for you, listener? Right there, in front of her face, that she's going to read out in a convincingly natural way.
The Wrestler is from 2008. It was directed by Darren Aronofsky, written by Robert D. Siegel, stars Mickey Rourke, Marissa Tomei, and Evan Rachel Wood, and it concerns an aging professional wrestler who, despite his failing health and waning fame, continues to wrestle in an attempt to cling to the success of his 1980s heyday. He also tries to mend his relationship with his estranged daughter and to find romance with a woman who works as a stripper.
Who's in it?
Yeah.
I said that. Mickey Rourke, Marissa Tomei, and Evan Rachel Wood.
Oh, yeah, you did. Sorry.
Yeah.
It just usually comes after the, you know...
Also...
Yeah, no, but we need, like, the director and writer and things.
I said that too!
Yeah, she did say that.
Fine.
Thanks a bunch for not listening.
She said Darren Aronofsky.
I had to try really hard to say that properly.
That's the weird thing. I can say his name, but it sounds like I'm saying it wrong every time I do.
I can say it, but it looks like I'm a dog eating peanut butter when I do.
Well, we can't see you, so that's fine.
It just sounds like one word.
So, Abby, are you going to say it while scratching the back of your ear with your foot give a bit of clarity, or are we just going with Dan, as you called him?
Oh, how dare you say that I didn't say it, and then when I tell you that I did, you say I didn't say it right.
I apologise.
If absolutely necessary, I will record a pick-up for you later on. But we are going to carry on with this show before I come in there and beat you to death.
With a steel chair.
Ram jam off the...
To my
bed.
Yeah, whatever's highest. Windowsill.
Now we got turnbuckles. So I stay in bed. So, Abby, you know... The Wrestler. What's the deal? Do you like wrestling? Do you like working on a meat counter? What is it?
I do heart wrestling, yes. I have worked on a meat counter, but I cannot say that I... Not that I didn't enjoy it, but nor did I enjoy it.
Well, neither did the Ram, who is the name of... Randy the Ram? Is that his name?
Yeah,
that sounds like a cartoon character.
What's his surname?
Robinson.
Robinson.
Yeah, but his name is Robin Robinson.
Yeah.
Damn,
which
you
is just cruel.
Blast you, Mrs. Robinson.
Which is why, like, I whenever I was, like, reading up on it afterwards, I see people saying, what's his problem with the name Robin? Well, because his name is ludicrous. Like, Randy the Ram sounds better.
Robin. Rob. Oh, Robbie Rob's.
That's the thing. His real name is Robin Ramzinski.
Ah, right.
Ramzinski,
that made him Randy the Ram Robinson. In that sideways way that wrestling names work. Take your name and then sort of turn it on its head.
It's usually not that, though, is it? I would say it's only in the last 10 years that wrestlers actually use their real names. Because it used to be, oh, what's your name? Oh, Jeff Rogers. Okay, you will be a matador. it got into... Yeah, I suppose it got into, like, the late 90s, and they started to use versions of their real names. And I suppose you had, like, Shawn Michaels, whose name is Michael... Shawn Hickenbottom. But you still have guys like The Undertaker, who, you know, Mark Calloway, but he's just, even when he was the biker and clearly just playing Mark Calloway, he still went with The Undertaker. But like,
thing, which isn't even a name.
No. But now they're just called like, oh, Gary Smith.
I think, of course, the obvious thing we're setting up here is a John Cena meme where someone goes, John Cena! And we play his music. But, of course, you know, that would be not happening because I'd have to edit that in. But let's just, you know, John Cena, rubbish name. Warrior, great name. Although, James Helwig is a pretty great name as well. But I could see why you turned down Helwig.
Okay, before I want to get this out of the way, Lanny Poffo, a.k.a. Macho Man Randy Savage.
I think it would be great if people like John Cena and you know, other real name, like Randy Orton type people, had they had a nickname that's like an animal or a weather or something hard sounding. And all the 80s guys were like, you know, Terry, James, you know, I just had regular names.
Wasn't Randy Orton a snake or something?
He's the Viper.
A while?
They have nicknames that you add now, like Big Match John or something. like you know,
Muscles Mike.
Sexual Chocolate.
This is like Welsh nicknames. You're going to get Die Div and Die Bent coming up.
Oh my god. Those are actual people I know as well. Or new. Right, the point is, old 80s wrestling names always have an animal or something. So this guy, who's from the 80s, is called the Ram. Randy the Ram. And, you know, if he was today, he would just be Robbie Robinson or whatever.
Yeah,
Robinstein. But, you know, we get... I guess he's an approximation of all wrestlers, right?
Yeah, he was designed to be all of the common themes between the wrestlers that they researched.
Yeah, and if you, like, you can identify them, like, you can definitely see Randy Savage in there, you can see Hulk Hogan. Mm. There's a lot of Jake the Snake with the whole relationship with his estranged daughter. I don't know if, like, I'm assuming everyone's seen Beyond the Mat.
I've seen a handful of actual documentaries, but I think this is quite a good fictional thing because it feels a little bit like everyone, and I think it kind of works. But we haven't really talked about why you picked it, Abby, and what we were expecting.
Darren Aronofsky said that he took a deliberate tack with this, which he referred to as proactive documentary making.
What's that mean? Is that just a fancy way of saying fake documentary?
But it's sort of, he wanted it to have that documentary feel, even though it was fictional and they knew what was happening.
Let's do a documentary about an 80s wrestler. Oh, who do we pick? Iron Sheik, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair? Oh, I can't decide. Why can't we just do all of them and make it fictional and therefore we'll reference everything? You're a wrestling fan, right, Abby? That's why... I mean, I got you into wrestling, but you've become your own wrestling fan without me now.
I have. But that makes it sound like it was some kind of rite of passage that I had.
Yeah, well, you know, personally, I used to watch wrestling as you're supposed to when you're about 12 to about 16, and I was into it in the classic Attitude Era of WWE or F or whatever, and then I left it, as people do... grow older, disinterested. And then I had a bit of nostalgia around 2011-ish, maybe 10, and got into it again. And then, like, because I was with you, I was like, look, this weird fake soap opera pantomime for fighters who just, it's the best thing ever. It's the most amazing high and low form of art I've ever seen. And Abby took to it mainly because, you know, you like theatre and weirdness.
Yeah. Wrestlers are the giraffes of the entertainment world.
It's not one thing or the other, is it? It's just weird.
Yeah.
Halfway
what
between...
is that thing?
Yeah. There's these men. They fight each other, but they have to talk about it for a bit. And they always have to have a reason. Like in boxing, they just, whoever wants to be champion has to beat the right person. In wrestling, you have to steal your girlfriend's car, crash it into someone else's wedding, and set someone on fire. You know, there's any number of reasons, but you have to have a soap opera-like reason to fight each other. And also
sure
there's belts.
I'm fairly sure all the things you just said are Kane.
Well, big fan of Kane, Abby, so, you know, that makes sense. But you and I got into wrestling together when I got into it again. And, Jamie, you used to watch back in the day as well, right? Back in the Attitude era, as they call it now.
I used to watch it in the early 90s as a little kid, and then I remember, I don't remember who it was, but a relative, like, made fun of it because it was fake, and I took that really personally, and I just stopped watching it.
Aww.
And then, next, Father Christmas, is he real? God.
But then I met, I got to know a group of friends when I was about 14 I was in secondary school, and they all watched wrestling. And I was like, this is stupid. Why do you guys watch this? But the key for me was that they also played WrestleMania 2000 on the Nintendo 64.
Mm.
Pretty brilliant game. Of all of the wrestling games.
Yeah, no, I still maintain now, decades probably later, WrestleMania 2000 and No Mercy on the N64 are the peak of wrestling video games. Mm. There's never been better since. Probably because all the SmackDown ones after about 3 are just utter shit. But, and WWE 12K, 16K, whatever the fuck they make now. It's the same fucking engine as SmackDown 2. Anyway.
We leave our beefs. I have beefs, but.
I started playing the games, and like I got into that because it was fun, and the creator wrestler was brilliant because it was simple enough that you could make wrestlers that looked quite like people you knew.
But you're not so complicated that you didn't have to assign every knee strike.
That you're basically like physically trying to recreate the person who you know. You're just pasting together something that kind of looks like them, and it works.
Yeah.
So. And I think at the time, SmackDown was on, like, Saturday mornings. So it was this, like, heavily censored version of SmackDown. But I started watching it, but I would only watch, like, the soap opera bits. And when the actual wrestling match started, I'd change the channel and then, like, go back later.
You sickened me. It's torture now.
This was the time when Mick Foley was commissioner.
Oh, wow.
Which, yeah, perfect. Because comedy goals. I was like, this guy's great. I don't know what's going on, but this is really funny. And then I started to learn who Mick Foley was, and I started to watch like the older Attitude stuff, particularly him and The Undertaker.
I mean, that is ridiculous match they have at Hell in a Cell. That was,
I think, the first time I watched a match, and I thought, well, fucking hell, this is not ludicrously fake. I mean, it is. Of course it's fake. It's staged. But he also, like, this guy, this fat man, who's clearly not in any kind of shape... just threw himself like 13 feet onto concrete,
smashing his teeth into his face.
Yeah, and then I read his book, and that was it. Then for about 3 or 4 years, I watched it just because I think I like the theatrics of it.
Hmm.
Yeah,
and I like the dedication that they have. Like, and this is all like part of this film. It amazes me how passionate you can be about a form of entertainment that you will basically ruin your life because you want to do it.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane.
Yeah, like Mick Foley is a perfect example. Like all the like extreme wrestling stuff that he did with the barbed wire and explosives, thumbtacks and all that stuff. Like he did absurd things, especially in Japan where wrestling is basically just death. Like and then you like read his book or you learn more about him, and he's quite possibly the nicest human being in the world. Like, there is no one more friendly and funny and kind than Mick Foley, and he's done these psychotic things to himself and other people. Mm. And I just think, like, the mindset of somebody who decides they want to be a professional wrestler, finds out what the business is like, and stays in it regardless. Yeah.
Because it's such a strange thing, because essentially it's a kind of medium of storytelling for children, but yeah, children who like violence, I guess.
That's the thing. It is, like, people say, oh, it's fake. Well, yeah, it is totally fake. It's absolutely staged. But at the same time, it's harder, as far as I can tell, than almost any other sport, because these guys they're in a tour bus for, like, 360 days a year.
Mm.
They don't get a break. They don't see their families. They're in pain all the time, because as fake as it is, they're still throwing themselves around and, like...
Yeah, and they've got big old schedules. There's non-stop. If you're not wrestling, you're training, you know. So
and
it's
like,
a dedicated life for what is essentially crap pantomime shows.
I always feel bad because my favourite stuff is, like most people, I think it peaked in the late 90s during the Attitude Era, because the stuff that they did then was just brilliant, because it embraced the fakeness and how over the top it was.
Mm.
And just took it to the extreme. But unfortunately, that meant that, you know, they did a lot of stupid things to each other and themselves.
Sure. Well, this is kind of what the movie's all about. It's taking a fake biographical approach to telling the story of a washed-up, burnt-out wrestler who passed his prime in the 80s and is now doing the sort of indie scene in America.
And, yeah, the the saddest things about this film is how realistic it is in terms of what most wrestlers end up like.
Yeah, you can kind of, like, real life stories, like documentaries I've seen about, like, the Iron Sheik or Ric Flair or someone, there's something, every moment of the film is part of someone else's reality, and it's generally the tale of wrestlers who are a certain age from a certain generation.
And when people think of professional wrestlers, like, back in the day, they would think of, like, Hulk Hogan or whoever.
Well,
or now,
some people, now, it's like giant haystacks. Yeah. This fat man who wears a strange, like, suit and, like, a hat and does nothing but be fat.
Yeah, just kind of lumber around the ring and pretend to punch everyone.
Yeah.
But, but you have people that people remember, like Hulk Hogan, or now you've got The Rock, who is now Dwayne Johnson. Like, he's an actor now, that's it. Or you have Steve Austin, who is one of the best there ever was, or The Undertaker, who's still going at 102 or whatever he is. And but those guys, the ones who are on top and they're famous and they're okay, are a very select few. And it's a mixture of, like, charisma, luck, and talent.
Yeah.
But you think of how big the industry is. The majority of them are Randy the Ram, or all the guys that you see. You know, all the other wrestlers that you see throughout this film, which is, I think, part of what's so affecting if you're, like, a fan, or even if you're it, because I know it said, apparently, like, Roddy Piper watched this.
And it really moved him.
Yeah, it moved him to tears, because, yeah, I would imagine this film is very much what it's like.
It basically holds up a mirror to all of these guys, especially the 80s generation, who, they lived a little harder. Like, now, their work is hard, but it's not so much cocaine, you know, hookers and road stories. It depends who you are as a person. But they all lived hard and played hard.
A lot of the stuff, I think, that certain wrestlers did to themselves in the late 90s in particular led to it having to become a lot more sanitized, because the WWE has gotten so big now that it's so mainstream that they can't let their wrestlers abuse themselves the way they used to.
Yeah.
And that's fair enough. Like, that makes perfect sense. But yeah, but you do have a lot of guys who are just, even when it's not that extreme, still just broken. Like,
and it's not, it's not just that, it's the portrait of a character who can't wrestle anymore because his era's gone. I think it addresses this bygone age where you were in your prime. But in a sense, I think the overall film is about this idea that a lot of wrestlers have, which is they're addicted to it, the attention, the fans cheer them, they're the centre of attention, and it's what they've done all their lives, is what they've been told they're good at. And they can't give up the spotlight. And you get people who are in real life, like Ric Flair, who wrestles, and you go, you shouldn't, and you're going to die in the ring. And this film is about those people who are stuck doing it because they have to, but also stuck doing it because it's the only thing they're good at and love.
Yeah, there's a lot of wrestlers. I've read a bunch of books, and I've heard a lot of interviews, and a lot of them, they did wrestling because they couldn't do anything else. They weren't gifted in school. They didn't have any connections with anything else. So literally the only thing they could do was wrestle.
And but my God, if they can't scoop, slam, leg, drop and put people through tables.
But even then, even the ones who can do other things, like, there's the ones who retire. Like, Terry Funk is a good example. I think
My God, yeah.
Yeah, he's well known enough that he would be all right if he retires. But whenever it's as if whenever he's tried to retire, he's gone, what am I going to do now? I'm bored.
Yeah.
So he just goes back and gets in the ring again.
Well, the moment of this film that really put me in mind of Terry Funk, because each part of the film, you can go, that's Thingy, that's this guy, that's Jake the Snake, that's Ric Flair, that's, you know, Ultimate Warrior. When they have their insane hardcore match, what's very nice about it is they cut to the end of the hardcore match that the Ram is having, and show the last moment. And then as he's in the dressing room getting all of his, like, staples pulled out of him and stitches sewn up and, like, having all of his injuries addressed, they cut to all the insane spots
what
in the wrestling
happened.
Match. Yeah. And it's like, it's more hardcore than some of the stuff ECW did. But, you know, it's everything. It's barbed wire, like, what, a barbed wire crutch? I think I haven't seen that in real life. Like,
that's the thing. That's the thing that is insane about just wrestling, is that nothing about that match has not happened.
Yeah. Abby, was it? Would you have some information about the leg that was used?
Oh, yeah, Tommy Dreamer.
Yeah, I read that was based on a real incident where a fan basically begged Tommy Dreamer to hit the other wrestler with his prosthetic leg.
You would, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course you would.
I mean, in ECW, the Extreme Championship Wrestling that was so famous when it was going, like, that was known for being hardcore, and the fans would hand you everything from frying pans to cheese graters. But in the film, they show a particularly brutal match where, you know, it was breaking glass, it was shattering, like, tables with barbed wire on. A guy, the Rams opponent, was just this balding, hairy glasses dude who was not barefooted and insane.
I'm pretty sure he's a real hardcore wrestler.
He is.
Well, he'd have to be, wouldn't he? Yeah. I personally didn't know who he was.
What's his name?
I'm afraid.
Necro something?
Necro Butcher.
I mean, yeah, and I guess, you know, this is where we're wrestling fans, but, you know, our knowledge isn't infinite, I guess.
Well, like, he's involved with those kind of matches. Like, I saw, I don't know where it was. Like, it was some match from one of these, like, underground place, like, little federations on matches on YouTube. Yeah. And, like, the match that I saw was, and it was specifically called a fluorescent light tube match.
Yeah.
So it had all of these weapons and also a copious number of fluorescent light tubes. And at one point, a guy fills one of those big, and the best part is they still use the fake weapons as well. They have one of those, like, practically tinfoil bins that they use. One of the guys filled it with fluorescent light tubes and then chucked the other guy in it head first.
Is there a triple fluorescent called John Moxley by any chance?
I think Dean Ambrose has had one of those matches, is what you're referring to.
He's described something very similar to what Jamie's described.
Well, they do. Yeah, well, they're great because the bulbs smash and don't leave too much shards of glass, but they still.
Well, you say that, but that was probably one of the bloodiest things I've ever seen.
This is the thing. Is though they pick weapons that are, you know, disposable, breakable, and look look showy and good when they break, they still have to crawl over tacks, barbed wire, and, you know, well, there's no faking stapling a dollar to your own head, which is what they show in this insane match to show you sometimes old guys and younger guys have to do little indie venues where the hardcore is pushed to the absolute limit, and this is what happens. The fans cheer, people are blown away, and it's kind of disturbingly bloody and horrible. But, you know, they still go back to the locker room and are friends, and then vomit and have a heart attack.
That was actually, like, that's one of my favourite parts of the film. I actually went to see this in the cinema when it came out, and I didn't really know what to expect, because at that point I'd only seen Requiem for a Dream.
Of all films, this is the only one you've seen.
The only Aronofsky film I'd seen was Requiem for a Dream, and it's not that I didn't like it, it's just that I'd never seen it before, and the first time I ever saw it was my first year of uni with a room full of students, none of whom really knew each other, because the year had just started, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning on, like, a Tuesday.
That is not the place
to watch it. And the lecturer was, and I'm not a morning person anyway, and the lecturer was like, okay, we're going to watch Requiem for a Dream. I was like, oh, I've heard this is pretty bleak. It fucking is, but they were like, because I wasn't ready for it. It kind of just made me feel sick, which it does anyway at the best of times. So I kind of had an iffy feeling about Aronofsky, but I went to see this in the cinema just because of being a wrestling fan. And the moment that it got to me, where, like, I thought this, because it, you know, it starts out as, like, he has a wrestling match, just kind of a shit little indie show. It's kind of violent-ish, but not really.
What I like, actually, about the opener is we get the posters that have mocked up to look like old-fashioned wrestling posters. But then the actual first bit of footage is him in what looks like a children's nursery sitting on a chair looking tired and worn out, not facing us. I love that as an opener because it just shows that, you know, makeshift locker room environment and the absurdity of this massive bloke in tights sweating and being tired in a children's, you know, play area.
Yeah, toys all around him. And then he's got a little action figure of himself in his car.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things that the film does right, like right off the bat, is the first thing, actually, just before what I was going to talk about, is that before that, the first match that they show, there's that sequence in the locker room where it cuts to all the different guys who have matches that night, planning the matches. Mm. And I was watching it, I thought, well, thank fuck for that. Like, this film is not patronising anyone.
It's not going to pretend wrestling is real. What's that film that Goldberg's in, where they... Ready to Rumble? Where it's got quite a few, wrestlers in. But it's under the pretense of, it's partly real, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a real sport or whatever. But yeah, I know, and the rest of the shows them planning out their matches, and they clearly, they're putting on a show. They're performers.
I love that moment where one of the guys is standing up while he's talking to the others, and he goes, oh, don't work the leg, everyone works the leg, work the neck.
Yeah,
and the next group up and go, no, we're working the neck. Oh, you're working, I'm sorry. Sorry.
You're working the ammo. Like, they all have to sort of shout and talk to each other en masse and scrap out the plan of what we're going to do. But, and it's interesting for people, I think, who maybe don't know what wrestling is. As a film, we're all biased. We like wrestling. But it shows you what this world is about, and it shows you how it works a little bit without being too indulgent.
It's a very good way for someone to go, oh, it's all fake and rubbish. It's like, well, yeah, but that's the film isn't about wrestling. It's like Rocky or Raging Bull. It's about the person and this person's journey. It just happens to be set in that particular world. But it also gives you a really good insight into that world and what these guys do to live in it, what that does to them. And that's why I thought that is great, because I was really happy that the film wasn't going to patronize anyone. And then the next bit that follows on from that is the follow-up match with Necro Butcher. And you have the nice contrast between a shit little match at a house show, and everyone's like, yay, Randy, and he's like, ugh. Yeah. And he doesn't get paid as much as he thought he was going to.
Yeah. And they show him slubbing about a bit, going to his caravan, driving his van.
He's locked out of his trailer because he can't afford the rent.
He's literally trailer park trash.
So he sleeps in his van. But then the match with Neck Butcher afterwards, when it shows him being treated for all the shit he's had to do, and having the staples pulled out and stuff, the way he starts, you can tell like he's trying not to throw up and stuff as they're he's shaking. He's fucked up. Mm. And then when he's when I first watched it, I didn't the heart attack was a bit of a surprise, but when he stood up and kind of slowly walked away and then just threw up, I thought, yeah, that's probably exactly what I would do if I'd just been through what he's just been through.
Well, I'd question you agreeing to do a match with a Necro Butcher.
Yeah.
I can't imagine him turning to you and going, you've been staple gunned before. Staple gunned, mate, what? Yeah, you know, staples. What? Yeah, they're fine going in, but coming out. I don't think you'd have gone, yeah. The Ram goes, yeah, in a sort of, I guess I have to.
He has to, yeah.
I'm too broke. I can't get into my trailer unless I pay my rent. And I guess we're doing this.
Yeah. It's just, there's so much about this film in terms of the way it treats professional wrestling and in terms of just as a film and as a story. It's so well done.
It gets it. It gets the world and the people. And that's really quite good considering it's not a documentary.
Yeah, but it also really tells a good story from it's interesting the way it's filmed is it's almost like a documentary. But the actual story, the structure of the story is very
theatrical.
It's very filmic. The whole
it's like a classic tragedy, you know. It's building this idea of this figure who's suffering but persevering, and it basically is the portrait of a fuck up who can't do anything for it. He's too in love with the world he's in and the fans, and he's too selfish to take responsibility for stuff like his daughter and his relationships and stuff.
I like the parallel with him and Marissa Tomei, who plays the stripper. And I like the fact that it never quite explains what their relationship is. He's obviously a regular customer, and they're sort of friends as a result.
But she keeps drawing the line of, look, you're a customer, I can't. You have to pay me to see me dance, and you're also paying for my time to talk to me. But there is you're a regular, and therefore different rules apply. And the whole thing is kind of about them developing a relationship. It is kind of fascinating, actually, to think, the female equivalent of wrestling in many ways is stripping, and it draws that slight parallel.
Well, that's it. I wouldn't even say it's slight. Like, it's on the nose. Like, she's in the same situation as him. She's getting old, and people aren't, like, no, like, she can't sell a dance to anyone. And it's not even, like, she's not in any way unattractive, but because she's older than all the other strippers, she gets nothing. They're all like, ugh, who's this old bag? Like, this really good-looking woman, and they're like, ugh, granny, get out. Like, it's the same, like, with Randy. He's like, he was this big star, but the only people who give a shit about him anymore are, like, you know, the hardcore fans, that's it.
Yeah, it's interesting that their crossovers are he obviously sympathises with her lifestyle choice, and, you know, wrestlers are lowbrow, crass people who end up in strip clubs a lot anyway. but, you know, because he respects her as a sort of, I guess, a fake performer or whatever, but also, you know, fancies her. But then on top of that, he's like her in that they're both getting to that age, like you say. They're both getting so they can't really be in the business they're in. And they have an affection for hating the 90s, loving the 80s, and being clapped out and worn down by life. And so, you know, we're encouraged as watchers to want them to, you know, have a successful relationship. And I'm intrigued to find out, you know, how does it work? You can't really go from being a client of a stripper to ever being a partner. That's a kind of foolish daydream most of the time, I guess, for these sad people who go to see strippers.
Speaking from experience.
Yeah, I want to distance myself. I have no problem with women who strip tease for a living, but it's not for me. I mean, I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't go.
I was about to say that you're speaking as if you have this secret life as a stripper that we weren't aware of.
Well, it's a secret life, Jamie, so obviously I won't admit to it. So, anyway, Abby, what do you make of their relationship? I mean, the actors, if you want. What are your thoughts? It was your choice. Let's hear from you a bit more.
What I like about it is that they're both sort of good-looking, but not too good-looking.
Well, that's very complimentary to Mickey Rourke.
No, but, well...
They look normal.
If you knew what Mickey Rourke looked like when he was younger and he didn't have so much furniture on his face, you would know.
Well, furniture's like a beard, but you mean like plastic surgery and life scars.
Yeah.
Go on, yeah.
But yeah, so it made them believable in what they were doing in order to be a stripper. In order to be a successful stripper, she would need to be fairly good-looking. But they weren't so good-looking that you hated them.
It's like the casting director had to backhandedly compliment them.
Yeah.
You're in shape, but you're washed up looking, so...
Yeah, you look like you would have been really good-looking in your prime.
Yeah.
Actually, the whole Mickey Rourke thing, that's another important part of this film that makes it work, is that this was Mickey Rourke's comeback after basically going through something very similar, because he was a big deal in the 80s, and he was a really, like, strikingly beautiful man. Like, and he was really, like, up and coming. Like, his star was on the rise, and he kind of had this parallel going with Bruce Willis. For some reason, they were seen as, like, versions of each other. And then, I don't know the full story what happened, but he decided he was going to become a boxer instead. Okay. And he did. And then he just went off the fucking rails. Like, didn't he fell into, like, alcoholism and stuff and just...
Yeah, he just went bananas.
He's got his,
his face smashed in. So his face now is a combination of, like, scar tissue and plastic surgery and stuff. And he...
But it's perfect for evil henchmen and awesome, gnarly-looking wrestlers. I mean, bleach blonde hair and stuff looks perfectly like every wrestler ever.
But he kind of did what happened to Randy, and then he got cast in this. Yeah. And I think a lot of his performance just comes from just honesty, and that's why it's so good. And it is really, really good. Like, beyond the obvious, like, emotional stuff, just all the little things he does, like, he really comes across as, like, human. Like, one of my favorite things about him is the way that he pulls his hair up into a little bun and puts his tiny old man glasses on.
Yeah.
And that body of the sort of Mickey Rourke's body, which is, you know, in shape, but he's like a big hench worn out bloke, and then just to have the reading glasses on for the little things, like gently wrapping in a blade so he can cut his head open.
Yeah.
And it's just so sweet and a nice contrast.
Yeah, there's something so matter-of-fact and real about everything he does. And the film follows him so intimately that, like, if every little, like, gesture that he does comes across as absolutely genuine.
Well, I think that some of the most interesting moments in the film come where he's interacting with little kids. Like, little kids don't appreciate him in the same way as everyone else, because they don't know when he was in his prime what he was like, but they know he's a legendary, you know, wrestler, TV figure. Yeah. And so around his van and trailer park and stuff, they occasionally badger him, and he, you know, he plays with them. And he has, there's one moment where he's with like a kid he calls because he's kind of upset because he's had a heart attack and he's recovering. And he just plays a Nintendo game that he's in. He gets to play as himself against this kid. And the kid's talking about Call of Duty 4, I think, is it?
Yeah.
And it's just that the kid is knowing, and it's kind of sad because the kid feels
bad for him. Yeah.
Yeah. But the kid's being nice, but he knows this guy. You're so behind the times. And, but Mickey Rourke's being friendly, and it's such a lovely scene because he's aware he's out of touch, but also he can't help it.
There's a bit earlier as well, when all of the kids are waking up Randy while he's in his van, because he got locked out and he slept in his van. They wake him up and he plays with them a bit, and one of those kids, in all seriousness, gets picked up and choked out by that man. Yeah. That kid is going to have that forever.
Not only that, I like the fact that he chokes up the kid on the ground. Like, I know, you know, wrestling is fake and everything, but a choke slam is grabbing someone by the throat, lifting them up, you know, with their help, but throwing them on their back. It's like, is that kid dead now?
I would volunteer for a choke slam off any wrestler, or indeed probably Mickey Rourke.
if I had the opportunity and not to go off on a tangent again, but like, as a wrestling fan, like, The Undertaker's always been my favourite. Mm. And if it was like, do you want a choke slam? Yes, I do. And I would sell it like a motherfucker. I would act like I was dead.
There was something really sweet in the documentary where a lot of the principal crew, I think, some of the actors and wrestlers that were there, they'd put two mats down by the ring, and the wrestlers were showing them how to jump out of the ring and land in some mats. Mm. And then all the regular people were having a go. And Darren Aronofsky said, no, that was rubbish. I have to do that again. We went back in.
There is something about a wrestling ring, boxing ring, whatever. If certain people step into there, you kind of just have to run the ropes and dive. It's something you never really get to do unless you're like privileged enough to be near someone who has a backyard ring or something. But like, it's an environment where you to step in a ring is to make you want to be like every wrestler you've ever seen.
Yeah, but that what you were talking about, the kid playing Nintendo with him, we're talking about parallels again. There's a really good callback to that later on, because when he's trying to develop the relationship with Marissa Tomei's character, he finds out she's got a son, a 9-year-old son, and he gives her the action figure of himself to give to her kid, and she does. And then the right towards the end of the film, because like, there's the whole build-up between Randy had a big match with a guy called the Ayatollah in the 80s, and they want to have like Randy versus Ayatollah 2 as a comeback, and then he has a heart attack and has to say no, but then everything gets fucked up and he says, yeah, I'll do it, fine, whatever, I'll do it, I don't care. So as he's on his way to do that, and you know there's a good chance he's going to die if he does that match, she sees her 9-year-old kid playing with that action figure.
I believe he's ram-jamming a Transformer. Of course, I mean, every pro wrestler would deck a Transformer in any fight, everyone knows that.
But it's a really... Because it didn't occur to me when I watched it years ago, so it's a nice kind of subtle moment that you've got early on in the film, this kid kind of playing a NES with Randy, and he's playing with a Randy action figure. It's just in a video game, and he's clearly just not really that into it. And then you have this 9-year-old son of the woman who is, they're clearly meant for each other, and her realization is that she sees the kid just playing with this action figure. And it's a nice kind of like a closed loop for the story.
Well, it's sort of, I think it's that in combination with that night at work where you could just tell that she knew that her working life had come to a natural end.
Yeah.
It's almost like she has to realise she needs to lower her standards a bit to meet him. Like, oh, I am like him, aren't I? And what's interesting is the whole film is about this guy's career, at the end of it anyway, but it's laced with all these sweet moments. And actually, the middle part is about him showing us how good a person he can be. Like, no matter how... Like the key moments, I guess, aside from when he's... Actually, some of my favourite bits, I'll just mention this a little bit. He's working in like, a convenience store, like, as shifting boxes and this and that, and he's asking for more hours. And what I love is it's the comedian Todd Barry is his boss, and he gets to put... He have all these sarcastic put-down lines towards the wrestler, like, just ragging on him needing to pay for more expensive tights or something. And
The weekend, yeah. I thought that was when you sat on other guys' faces.
Yeah. there's some choice lines with Todd Barry in this film. Which I just loved because I love Todd Barry. I think he's funny. But he's working in this job, and he's even when he's like agrees to do the deli counter and doesn't, you know, it's not really suited to him, he's being really jolly, almost too jolly and clumsy to the point where he's so chipper he forces other people who are asking for stuff to like there's a sad looking guy who's just ordering something, and he's like makes him step back so he can throw it to him like a football in American football or something.
The great bit about that scene is that it's real.
Well, he was just playing deli.
Aronofsky put Mickey Rourke on the deli counter and had him work it that day.
Yeah, they had some people. They had a couple of actors so that they definitely had something to use. Yeah,
but then a lot of the people that he was serving were just customers.
Yeah.
Well, Abby, they just let him go for it.
Well, Abby, as an ex-deli operative.
Yeah,
that old lady who asked for the tub of whatever and had a little bit out, little more in, little more out. I mean, how real is that?
Yes, as someone who works in food service, that's 100% genuine.
There are, because we were more about the sliced meats than the, you know, potato salad. I didn't have that exact thing, but there were people who would just say, "Can you slice my ham extra thin?"
Yeah.
But what would they follow it up with, Abby?
It would be more... It's just this sort of general tone they have. It's not the words. It's the meaning.
But it's they're so fussy. And then they say stuff like, "Oh, don't worry, it's just for the dog." Or, you know.
And anyone who came up to me and said, "Oh, can I have half a dozen slices of this one on extra thin, but can I not have the first slice?" And then say to me, "Don't worry, it's only for sandwiches." They were lucky there was a counter between me and them, because I would have wrung their neck.
If for anyone who is listening, who's ever worked in food service, they know that food service is one of the places. I would imagine food service and a war zone are where you learn about the best and the worst of humanity. You do, like, when you're serving customers in food service, you encounter some of the best people you will ever meet coming to you to eat. Mm. And you will also encounter the scum of the fucking earth. Like, people who shouldn't be allowed outside.
In the case of the movie, what I like about it is he's so chipper, you're right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just remembered something from real life. I had it again in the shop where someone held up a turkey thing to me. I went, "Is this turkey?" I'm like, "Does it look like a turkey?" "Yes, it's a turkey."
It's a very big chicken. What I was going to say was, I like that he's forcing himself to be chipper and cope with this mundane job he has to do extra hours in to pay for his life, I guess. And he's on an insane amount of like actual medicine, and then he's also buying like illegitimate drugs from another wrestler.
Well, he has to quit the steroids and shit because of his heart, so...
Mm.
I will say, though, I don't think he's forcing himself. I think he does, when he's on the deli counter, it starts out that he's trying really hard to be, friendly customer service, but as it goes on, he starts to actually enjoy it, like making that guy go along and stuff, and that's... That simple situation of just having a normal job and quite liking it is what leads him to phone everyone and just say he's retired.
That's true. He does. He commits to being retired from it as well.
Yeah. He's like, "Yeah, this is all right."
Well, this is what I wanted to mention, is he has a moment towards the middle of the film where his life, he starts, even though he's him, he doesn't stop being himself. He starts doing things correctly. He's nice to this stripper who he likes and wants to befriend and maybe more. And, he's not pressing her ever to, like, have a relationship.
Yeah.
But he's pleasant and he does eventually get somewhere, has one day out. She helps him, like, find some gift for his daughter, who he's estranged from. And he meets his daughter, and it's an obviously difficult, I was never there for your relationship, again, paralleling real-life wrestlers. Mm. And he actually has a successful little day trip where they go to, like, a rundown pier, and he reminisces, and she doesn't really remember, but she kind of likes him again.
She kicks in that door like a pro.
Yeah, I know. The whole middle part of the film where he, like, starts to pull himself together and fix everything is great, but also it's so painfully sad because you know where it's going, and you can see that inside there is like a really decent person, but he just can't help his nature.
Mm.
And because he's done so much to fuck up in the past, it kind of, like, he can only get good to a certain point, and then it all when it implodes, it's painful to watch.
Like, yeah, I remember, and he's never deliberately mean or anything.
No,
it's just he's a fuck up, and
instead of
doing the responsible thing, he gets a bit nostalgic, goes to watch wrestlers wrestle when he doesn't have to be there, he can just watch, gets a bit, teary eyed, and then hangs out, gets drunk, and bangs some slapper in the toilets and ruins his life.
I'll say, I'd forgotten about the bizarre but hilarious fireman joke.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is, like, I don't know if you guys watched it, or, like, I don't know if you can cotton onto it if you're not watching it with subtitles, but, because my wife's like half deaf and we watched it together, so we always watch films with subtitles on. But when he's shagging that woman in the bathroom, the subtitles say imitate siren.
And then he wakes up in her bed and this old fireman model posters.
I love the fact that that joke comes out of nowhere and then is never referenced again, because it's such a perfect little, like, slice of real life where you just encounter something fucking weird and you go, I'm going to step away and just pretend this didn't happen.
And she had a ferret?
A what?
Yeah.
A ferret.
She had some little creature in that little cage.
She was just mental, and he just thought, I better get out of here.
She's got a very interesting and damaged story, I think, this strange woman.
But the whole, like, where he takes his daughter to that beach.
Pier, like, rundown ballroom type thing.
And he has that moment, that short monologue, where he basically just apologizes for everything he's done. And there's a reason that was the clip that they showed constantly when this film came out.
Mm.
Because that little bit of performance is so good, and it's so heartfelt. And I almost feel like it's Mickey Rourke apologizing to the audience for his, like, 80s films. And it's hard to watch. And then when it all gets fixed, and then he goes and he tries to press Cassidy, that's Marissa Tomei's character, he tries to press her a bit further for, like, another date or whatever, and she says no, there's a line. And it's all been going so well for him at this point.
Yeah, because she has a sort of date with him that they establish, they have a common ground and get to know each other non-professionally. And it is she bails from it early, but there's a sense of this could work, and she's maybe reluctant.
But it freaks her out. But you can, again, though, her reason for it is, it makes sense. It makes sense why she has that line with the customer that she can't cross. But because of how well everything's gone and how shit it was for him, that just flips a switch. So yeah, he goes and sees a wrestling match, and then
she shouts at him at a bar, and he kind of loses his temper and basically tries to force her to give him a
dance. He does the worst thing he could do, like, no, come on, I want to dance, and it's like, oh god. And then the downhill is so rapid, and then goes home and falls asleep and then wakes up at night and you know he's missed the dinner date he'd set with his daughter.
And it's so unfortunate because, you know, like, essentially, if he'd have had another, like, a heart problem, he could maybe have gone, look, I couldn't come because I had a good reason. And, of course, the truth is he was drunk and he says that and it's honest, but it's not good enough because he's been an absentee father. And you go, yeah, that is the last straw. And it's such a shame. It's just the whole thing collapses in on itself and you go, this is so
lame. It's fucking agonizing to watch. And again, like almost everything else in the film, it's agonizing to watch because it's so real.
Mm.
Like, there's nothing about that feels like I'm watching a movie.
It's
very authentic. It's almost like, it's, you know, when you're in somebody's house and they have a fight and you're still there and you're like, you're sitting in another room and you could hear them in the kitchen just really going at it. And you're like, I don't know if I could leave. Like, I should, but I don't want to go in there and be like, guys, I'm going to go. it's horrible. And I when I went to see it in the cinema, like, I wanted to leave the theater at that point and then come back in about 10 minutes because it was just, and you feel so bad for him.
And that's a crucial point there, where that after everything falls apart, everything's gone. He's got nothing left to live for. So in a way, that's kind of a motivation to say, I want to do that anniversary 20 years match against the Ayatollah, a.k.a. the Iron Sheik. Not the Ayatollah of Rock and Roller, Chris Jericho, not you.
A.k.a. Bob.
Bob, I love that they call him
the
Bob.
The car dealer from Arizona.
Like, the behind-the-curtain stuff with all the different wrestlers is quite good. Like, I think the only wrestler I genuinely recognised was R-Truth, and he was just there as a small cameo to have a, all right, mate, and had an awkward bit of, how's it going? Yes, you know, it's fine.
Remember me? No. There's also the second most uncomfortable scene of the film, where he's back at the deli counter, but everything's gone to shit.
Oh,
and he can't take the abuse anymore.
Abby, are you going to be able to relive this part of the scene? You were particularly affected by the accident.
Pre-podcast, I was saying to you guys that I could handle all of the wrestling stuff, all the barbed wire, all the broken glass, all of that. But when he punches that meat slicer, it does me in.
I love how insane he goes when he does that.
Well, he's like, elbow dropping the aisles as well, isn't he?
He goes fucking mental. And it's like, but
guess I'll cross with Todd Barry.
But you'd like that frustration, even though like what he does is way over the top. Mm. It's still a relatable frustration.
Career-ending heart attack, a girlfriend leaving you, a daughter you almost rekindled a relationship with hating you. I mean,
and you work in retail.
Yeah,
food service as well.
Mm. And you got Todd Barry riding you all the time.
Yeah,
figuratively.
But I like the way he just he punches the meat slicer, blood everywhere. He throws blood all over the counter and smears it on his face, and then just knocks shit off the shelves. And
it'd have been good if there was an old lady going, just a little bit thinner slice on that knuckle.
But a great part that makes it real is it shows him in his truck afterwards, wrapping his hand and going, "Oh fucking hell!"
I am a knob. Yeah.
Yeah. What?
The other aisle-based scene I like is him and another bald, chunky wrestler are going around testing out kitchen appliances and this and that as cookie sheets and what can we hit over each other's heads and be all right. And I like the bit where they get the guy who they're serving. They're having a bit of a laugh, and that the clerk or whatever, they make him take a little shot of the.
Again, it's a scene that is clearly improvised, and that had no idea who these guys were or what the fuck he was doing.
But I like that he volunteered his head to be smashed with the little metal thingies. It was good on him. But there's loads of, it's full of humour and tragedy, and then it just builds this nice, ending of, he's doing this important last match. He makes a mini speech about how he's always done it for the fans, which is kind of like the only thing that makes wrestlers not commit suicide is the fans. Yeah. I think if you've fucked up everything, but you've always got the people who will always cheer you, then that's what you can hold on to.
That's again the way everything kind of comes together. at the end of the film with him going, like, going to that match. And then Marissa Tomei, like, realizing this, like, I should have taken him up on this. And going all that way, finding him just as he's about to go out. And he says, like, the only place I get hurt is out there.
In, like, the real world, meaning.
Yeah, in the ring is where I belong. And he goes anyway, and she's trying to tell him,
you're going to die if you do this, and I will be with you if you don't.
Yeah, but he's like, it's too late, isn't it? And he just goes out. And it's like, but that's what he says. Like, it doesn't matter at this point. Like, even, like,
they are literally chanting my name. I mean, it would be me.
Yeah. But what I also thought was nice was when he originally did that monologue in the ring, because that was at a Ring of Honor event, they booed him. And then Darren Aronofsky took to the ring and said, guys, wise up. And, like, explained to them the significance of it in the film. And the crowd did, we fucked up.
Yeah.
And then they redid it, cheering.
Oh.
But I love the fact that, like, they filmed these at actual events.
Yeah, and they keep pouring on these little layers of tragedy at the end, where there's a few different places in the match where he could have stopped the match.
Yeah, because Bob, the Ayatollah, is like, are you sure you're all right? Like, and he's clearly pushing himself hard enough because he doesn't care.
Yeah, it's like he wants to die, and that's what makes it tragic.
Yeah, they just have those, like, is he gonna collapse moments, and then he puts the boot into to Bob or the Ayatollah, the used car salesman guy, who is reprieving his role as an evil villain who waves a flag from a country that isn't America and therefore is evil. But I like, they show the talking they do, both real, like, because in a wrestling match, I don't know if people who don't know about wrestling would watch it and go, oh, this is wrong, they're talking to each other. It's like, they talk to each other a bit in the ring, they try and mask it, unless they're John Cena.
I would describe them as a little chatty in this one, though.
Well, at the end, he's talking, like, the Ayatollah has to talk to him and reassure that everything's all right, because he's looking a bit peaky and ill. And, you know, they're both old, so they have to watch each other's back and take it easy. And they wrap it up eventually after Mickey Rourke stumbles his way up to the top rope and has a really proud moment as he sort of does his little taunt gesture with his elbows and stands again, there proud that, in the that, rafters.
That shot of him standing on the top turnbuckle and the crowd chanting, and you can see there's like this, praising Mickey Rourke's performance again, there's such a mixture of like happiness and desperate sadness on his face. Because at the same time, it's like the rush of like, this is what, like, this is all I need. But at the same time, it's that sadness of, this is all I know. Like, this is the peak and probably the end. Like, the film doesn't say either way. It's up to you whether he dies or not. Because he's clearly on the edge of another heart attack, and then he jumps off the top rope and it just cuts to black.
I think what's interesting about it as an image is, A, any time a giant man climbs up in colourful tights onto a turnbuckle and stands there going, you're too big to be balancing up there and jumping about. Yeah. And then an arena of people chatting, in this case, Ram Jam, which I thought was a type of Jamaican music, but I could be wrong. They're all cheering for him, and he's there, he's this giant man about to leap, and he leaps, like you say, off the screen, and they, instead of having like the finish to the match, they just have it end and sort of like no sound of him landing. Cut, maybe insinuating he died, maybe saying...
Aronofsky said he wants it to be up to the viewer whether he died or not.
So, at this point, I would say, in my universe, he lands it, gets the pin, goes backstage, she's not there, but they rekindle their relationship anyway. He makes up with his daughter, and they live happily ever after with his new adopted son and his estranged but now slightly friendly daughter, and he dies at the Hall of Fame induction he gets several years later.
Just like every wrestler in real life, it's always a happy ending.
Yeah, well, not every wrestler ends, their life ends poetically and nicely. But
I listened to Ric Flair's podcast.
Yes.
And I think every show, at least every other show, he's saying, like, I don't know how I'm not dead. I don't know how I'm one of the last guys standing. It doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make sense. Ric Flair. Oh, that's what I was saying. Is the hardcore match reminded me of Terry Funk. Because Terry Funk, an old man from a legendary wrestling family and could have retired many times over, keeps throwing himself and other people through barbed wire tables, ladders, chairs, like fiery tables, thumbtacks. I mean, Terry Funk has killed himself like no one and is still alive. And Ric Flair has put on so many matches. I can't, like, you know.
Terry Funk at this point, his knees are so damaged, he doesn't have the lower parts of his legs left. He's like Cotton Hill from King of the Hill.
Yeah. Well, he can rip off his leg and beat someone to death with it.
Yeah.
Terry Funk is incredible, and Ric Flair should have stopped. I've seen his arse far too many times. I think his forehead must be made of paper mache or no, tissue paper that can bleed at the idea of someone hitting you. And I think he can't stop himself crying on a constant basis. He's so emotional. So there are wrecks of men who should long ago have died, but are probably just going to die in the ring, really, because they just can't say no. Like Ram, the whole thing is about not being able to stop wrestling.
Yeah, and that's what that last moment is. It's at least the way I look at it, is that he ends up dying in the ring because what else has he got? Like, even if he survived at that point, he would probably wish he had died. That's why he's pushing himself so hard in that match.
It would actually be a really great heel move on the Ayatollah. Actually, Bob's heel move would be to roll out the way, let him miss, and then small package him for the win. That'd be great.
That would ruin everything.
Yeah. He has a heart attack being beat.
Humiliate him at the moment of his death.
Yeah.
The greatest heel in the history of wrestling.
Yeah, that's it.
I reminded myself about how brilliant this film is because I haven't watched it for ages, but I just think it's fantastic, and it looks for such a, like, it looks so grubby, but it looks so good as well because I watched it on Blu-ray and like it's got such a nice like grainy texture.
Well, the locations are great because they're all dingy, indie, low budget places, bleak, desperate places. They're all great.
It does such a good job of like starting out bleak, giving you a real feeling of hope, and then just
shoving it all on the floor and kicking it.
Yeah, it's an old fashioned tragedy, and it's a very almost like cliched story, but it's about something that nobody has really addressed until Beyond the Mat, really, in the late 90s, and then everyone kind of forgot about it. This is like a follow-up to Beyond the Mat. Like, it takes all the stuff that was in that documentary and creates a fictional character out of it.
Mm.
And it does it. So, and there are so many moments that just capture his character and the industry so well. Like the signing thing he does, where they're all sitting in a little room
with the old table wrestlers with broken in wheelchairs and just sleeping on their face because no one's in the hall. And then the sad little fans, the lovable fans, who they're all nice to, but they're just, you know, a couple of guys in their 30s or a young man with his mum, you know.
Yeah. And it's just, it's so...
And the asking for the money as well when you sign an autograph. So.
Yeah, and putting it in his little bum bag.
Oh, yeah. What's with wrestlers and bum bags? Seriously, wrestlers love bum bags. Them. Yeah, the British Bulldog loves them. Everyone from the Hart Foundation, bum bags.
Hey. Everyone in the 90s had a bum bag.
And 80s. I mean, the bum bag was the fashion accessory of the wrestler and taxi driver and person at a counter. Fanny packs, we should say.
Fanny pack, yeah. Mm. It's such a magnificently sad film.
Mm.
Like, and everybody's brilliant in it. Mickey Rourke is brilliant in it. I think it's really sad that this was his comeback. That up as well. Yeah. Now he's in, like, what the fuck is he in now?
He was in Iron Man 2.
Oh, yeah, he was. He was really good in that, even though it wasn't a very good film.
Bird. Get me Bird.
But have you, now he looks fucking... He's lost loads of weight. He's really, like, skinny and, like...
Wait, we're not judging his whole career. This isn't a retrospective.
I know, it's a shame, because he's so good in this.
He can be good a lot, though. Like, I even like it, like... I forget what he's in. It's like a Robert Rodriguez film where he's in like a purple suit and he's holding a tiny chihuahua in his hand all the time.
That's probably his actual dog as well, because he loves his tiny dogs.
It's like he can't put it down and he has to hide it from the boss. I really love Mickey Rourke with a tiny dog in his hand.
Yeah, though he actually does have tiny dogs in real life.
Is that a euphemism or...?
No, he does. I remember years ago... I think it was when The Wrestler came out, actually. He appeared on the Jonathan Ross show, and I think he had the tiny dog with him.
I wouldn't be surprised if Jonathan Ross gifted him one, because he's that much of a douche. He's that kind of guy.
It's great. And there's so many little touches to it. Like, there's not a lot of... music is used very sparingly in the film, apart from like certain like sad moments. But there's that really nice piece of music that plays when shit hits the fan.
Got a bit of classic 80s, you know, rock to give happiness to Ram in those moments.
Also, when like the use of sound is really good, because you don't notice it, but you feel it. Like when he's about to have that first heart attack, and there's this like droning sound that makes you feel sick, and it like. Emphasizes his like how nauseated he is, because
great moment is when he's getting ready to be the first day on the deli counter, and he's hearing the chanting in his head as he approaches the drapes or whatever that he has to pass through to get to the deli, and then when he passes through the chanting just stops and it's just a deli. Great.
What's
bad about this film? Abby, you picked it. You must have picked it knowing it was great. So what are the bad things?
I don't think... It's not... I didn't pick this because it's one of those movies where we get to say, oh, the good things are this, oh, the bad things are that, and then overall it's really confused. The reason that I picked it is because it's one of those really great movies that people might not give a chance to because of what it's about.
Yeah. They assume it's going to be some cheesy shit about wrestling, and wrestling's all fake and gay and tights and whatever. Why would I watch that? It's got Mickey Rourke in it, he's shit. Like, there's so much working against it.
Yeah. I'm glad that it got all of the critical success that it did. Yeah. Because it could easily have been forgotten otherwise, because people just wouldn't give it a chance.
Wrestling movies on the whole are usually terrible. Usually because the WWE make them and they can't do anything correctly. Even their own product they get wrong. They end up... I think the idea with wrestling is, it can only ever be broad comedy or something terrible or action-y schlock. And when really, you can do good drama and, you know, wrestling people's lives can be interesting.
Mick Foley, when he wrote his first of nine autobiographies he's written.
He's had the life, though, hasn't he? God.
That first book he wrote, which he wrote himself, which was rare anyway. He didn't have he initially had a ghostwriter, but he ditched them because it was weird. So he wrote all 1,200 pages of that book longhand.
With sock on, just for
he told so many just mental stories. Because his life was insane. And not because his life was insane, but because he's a professional wrestler. And I think all of them have, like, every person in the industry has the potential to tell as many crazy stories as he does.
Doesn't he also think he's Santa as well? Like,
I think
he's obsessed,
He's so obsessed with Christmas that he's bordering on, like, psychotically believing he's actually Santa Claus, yes. funnily enough, I haven't seen it, but I would just let anyone, like, listening to this who is a wrestling fan know, there is a documentary that I think is available on Netflix that Mick Foley made specifically about mall Santas.
Really?
Yeah, and he made it, and he got made up as Santa for it.
What was the film where Big Show plays Santa in like a comedy with lots of mall Santas? Is that like an Adam Sandler film that happens in?
Oh.
No, it's that Arnold Schwarzenegger one, is it?
Jingle All the Way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Just another mall wrestler. Link.
A Mick Foley mall Santa documentary. And I think it's on Netflix and I need to watch it. And we all probably do.
We all do. Yep. Now that you've said that, that is on my tick list for life.
The Iron Sheik documentary is pretty good, and I've heard Jake the Snake Roberts' documentary about his life is out and good. But Iron Sheik's one is great because Iron Sheik is the best Twitter account in the world because he's the most insane, sweary, crazy man.
I found out some disappointing things about the Iron Sheik's Twitter account.
Well, he's like part of the documentary showing the young men who helped him put his words onto Twitter. He's not typing everything himself, but he is like a wrestling Tourette's man.
he is out of his mind.
Yeah.
But they all are.
Yeah, they are. And this is that's why the film's good, is because it gets that.
Because it's just an insane industry, and it fosters so much insane dedication in its performers and the fans, and it's just fascinating. And the film is great because it tells such an honest version of it, because it doesn't dress it up, it doesn't try and make out that it's real, it doesn't patronize its audience, and it gives such a everyone gives such a genuine performance, and it addresses something that is fairly new in terms of like realistic films. That I like, the only criticism I have of it is that the story's pretty by the numbers, like it's a pretty cliched like rise and fall has been washed up sports star film, but it's about something so previously unaddressed that it doesn't matter, because it's fascinating to have that insight into something that most people just write off as fake nonsense for kids or, you know, rednecks or whatever.
It's also a new form of tragedy. There aren't many professional wrestlers beyond, like, you can't have this story. You can have other sports stories about different sports, different people, but, you know, there aren't 80s wrestlers in the 70s. They had 70s wrestlers and 60s wrestlers and all this, but it's a very unique modern beast, the aging should retire wrestler.
Yeah, because the film came at an interesting time where you do have wrestlers now who still, like at the time, I don't think Ric Flair had retired yet.
And who knows when that's not. They could always step in the ring again.
Retirement means nothing in wrestling. But like, a prime example as well is The Undertaker. Like, I don't want to date us too much and say specifically when we're recording this, but like...
The streak is not alive. It is dead.
Yeah, and it's...
Just get in there. We are aware that he didn't, you know...
And he's at a point where he's legitimately... He's one of the best that there's been, and he's like an icon of it. And he's played one character longer than any other wrestler has. But the mystique is kind of still there, but he is clearly now a worn-out, aging man who, just by the nature of his job, is fucked up beyond repair, and he needs to retire. But like, and he's because he's in the WWE, which is like the biggest company, he's well off enough that he could have retired 10 years ago. And
he's not going to be struggling for money in the same way.
But
yeah, I think he's in real estate.
Rick
Flair, on the other hand, who has like 40 divorces going on, he might need to keep wrestling till he dies.
But it's, you know, is it the same thing as Randy in this film? If he retires, what else has he got? Like, how much is he going to miss it?
Just driving around on his Harley Davidson with Michelle McCool, if he's still with her. I don't even
know. Oh, fuck. Yeah, fuck those. He dates everyone. But,
there is that thing, though, where... It's not every wrestler. It's a particular group of wrestlers as well. Yeah, Edge was forced to retire because of his health.
But he did.
Yeah, he accepted it.
Yeah. It's the new generation wrestlers, in 20 years' time, there'll be movies about them, and they won't be as messed up because they managed their money properly, and they retired when they were told to, and they listened to doctors, and they knew what was good for them.
Healthy. Yeah.
They go on to be film stars and succeed at life.
But it's an interesting industry, and I'm glad this film is there, and I'm glad it got the critical acclaim and the recognition it got.
And I'm glad they didn't cast Hulk Hogan as was rumored, because that would have been terrible.
No, that was Hulk Hogan lying through his teeth. Oh, Aronofsky absolutely. Said that.
Damn you, Grandpa Terry.
However, it was going to be Nicolas Cage.
That would have been terrible. I love Nicolas Cage, but it would have been wrong.
It would have been fucking brilliant, but not in the same way this film is.
Yeah, it would have been Vampire's Kiss good. Not The Wrestler good, which is genuine, authentically original, charming, and great.
Yeah. It's one of those films that I... Like, if anyone ever... Like, I don't really watch wrestling anymore. I will occasionally change my mind about the network and pay $10 and watch some old...
Sorry, $10? $9.99, mate. Get it right.
And I'll watch like some events from like the late 90s for nostalgia. But I'll probably never watch it regularly again. But if anyone ever like says, "Why did you ever watch it in the first place?" This would be the film that I would show them, because like this is it's another fucking world. It's insane.
It is busy. I feel like we're naturally wrapping up, so I want you to bear in mind a rating, and I'm thinking what wrestler it is.
Oh,
I was going to say what finishing maneuver it is, but...
Well, you know, go with whatever you want, but okay. Just bear that in mind while you're saying your piece. You'd show people this film, Jamie.
Oh, yeah, this is I like, were they like, ooh, it's all fake. Well, I'd show them this, and I'd, and it's that mentality of, like, look at the dedication, not only of, like, Randy's character, but the young guys who are wrestling all these shitty little shows, and he even tells them, you know, it's the politics that run the show, just stick with it, you'll get there one day, and they probably fucking won't, and they know it, and they do it anyway, because it's genuinely what they want to do, and there's very few other industries like that, and not only that, but just as a film, it's so well done, and it grabs you emotionally so well.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it doesn't show you the like the big success story. It doesn't show you the WWE best of the best stuff. It shows you the, like, we're going to have a match where I stick a fork in your head. It shows you the grubby underbelly of indie wrestling. Less off, not the millionaires who work hard, but, you know, are successful.
In every way, it's such a, like, emotionally, stylistically, it's such a visceral film. Like, it has like a physical texture about it, and it kind of, like, it makes you feel sick and it makes you feel sad. It's just, I don't know. I can't really fault it. It's really, really well done.
And that is why it is the Tombstone.
I don't know. Well,
what would you say? What wrestler? What finishing move? What?
Finish. Well, I want to go with the finishing move, but. Tombstone's too obvious because I've talked about, like, The Undertaker being my favourite. I would actually say it might be... I would say it's the original Shawn Michaels super kick sweet chin music. I nearly said sweet shin music.
That would be a very low
dude,
kick.
Dude Love, very different. That one is... that one's the film No Holds Barred. It's Shawn Michaels in his prime. Shawn Michaels in his prime doing the sweet chin music, because it's that kind of, like, showy, like, guy in sparkly tights doing, like, all his, like, show off stuff, and it looks cool, it looks amazing, but at the same time, he's full on kicking somebody in the face, and, like, you know, he'll slap his thigh to make the noise.
Stamp the ground a bit and...
But how many times has he accidentally, genuinely, full-on kicked his opponent in the face?
So you're saying it's sweet chin music, but it actually does connect a little bit.
It's that showiness, but with that realism underneath.
Potatoing someone in the face.
Yeah, the brutality of a fake... the brutality of the theatre of it. And it encapsulates it perfectly.
Mm. Abby...
It's that time Shane McMahon was up incredibly high. He climbed that rigging that was over the top of the Titantron to do an elbow drop into
wood.
Wasn't it tables and cane, I think.
a bit of padding and cables, but yeah, you know.
Was it Kane, or was it not Big Show?
He's done some insane matches. Big Show, Kane, Kurt Angle, and there's been the ridiculous spot in all of them. I think that might have been.
So what Abby's saying is it's Shane McMahon, because this film is basically, why are you doing this to yourself?
There's no reason for you to do this. Yeah, he is Vince McMahon's son. He doesn't need the money.
Yeah,
doesn't need any of that stuff. He's just doing it anyway because he's a maniac.
A normal job at a meat counter in a deli.
But it is spectacular, though, right? That's what you're saying. Yeah. It's a great spot in the wrestling history, Hall of Fame, whatever. Like, it's a moment where you go, wow, that is incredible. And this film is that. That's your point, Abby, is it?
Mm.
See, I hadn't got a move in mind. I was going to say just, it's like Jake the Snake, isn't it? Because it was great. It was 80s. That was his heyday. It's gimmicky. It's animal-related, because he's Ram. Snake makes sense. But then there was that period of washed up, overdoing it, alcohol, drug abuse, problems, failure, 90s. And then this film ends before DDP Yoga, bringing Jake the Snake back to life and putting him in the Hall of Fame and patting him on the back and going, you can rekindle your relationships a bit. So it's like...
In that way, it is Jake the Snake up until 2008.
it's the bit where he was on the indie scene, looking like he was going to die, fighting people like Scott Hall or whoever, you know, like proper washed up, oh my gosh, you need some DDP yoga.
Yeah.
So that's what I was going to say, but I don't know.
There's a quote from Vince McMahon that he told to Mick Foley that this film actually reminded me of. Like everything that you see the wrestlers do, and again, you know that it is the kind of shit that they do for no reason other than that's what they want to be. And it was after that notorious like Hell in a Cell match in 98 with The Undertaker, and like for anyone who doesn't know, like that, it's the match starts out on top of the cell, which is a big cage that goes around the ring that has a roof on it. It's like it's about 13 feet high.
Something like that, yeah.
The match starts with Mick Foley, who's at the, you know, he's not an in shape guy. He's a big fat man, and he climbs.
There's an Undertaker fighting a shabby man in a suit with a mask on.
Yeah, but anyway, the very beginning of the match is Mick Foley being thrown 13 feet
into the announce table.
Yeah, and you know, he hits the announce table, but underneath that is the concrete floor of the stadium. He dislocates his arm. He smashes in his face.
By God.
They take him out on a stretcher. Match is over at this point. Nobody knew he was going to do that.
Undertaker's looking a bit, oh dear, I might have actually homicided someone.
Yeah. Mick Foley gets up and goes back to the ring, goes, no, match is still going, climbs up to the top again, falls through it into the ring.
Not just falls, gets chalk slammed through the roof to the ground, hits a chair on the way down.
Yeah. Is at this point concussed to the point where he can barely stand, but carries on the match anyway for about 5 minutes, because that's all he can do.
Yeah.
And then dies and gets taken out.
My favorite part of this is Terry Funk comes out to stall for time and check Mick Foley's okay because they're friends. So Terry Funk comes out in his civvies and Undertaker choke slams him literally out of his shoes as a sort of filler bit while they check Mick Foley isn't actually dead.
Anyway, it's a spectacular show of like ridiculous. Like the ridiculous extent someone will go to entertain people in an industry like this. And the quote from Vince McMahon is, after Mick Foley went backstage and like kind of pulled himself together, Vince McMahon, the owner of at the time WWF, came up to him and he said, Mick, that was absolutely amazing. Don't ever do something that stupid again.
Yeah.
And this film just captures that quote perfectly. Like, you're too old. Like, don't do that. Don't do this to yourself. And it's, like, everything Randy does is that quote.
And it's the defying it as well. It's the, you know, yeah, pushing the envelope when you shouldn't.
Yeah.
So, if anything, we're saying this film is like, it is the equivalent of the wrestling match where Undertaker fights Mankind in Hell in a Cell. And it's a moment that captures wrestling at its best. It's insane, is heartwarming, devastating,
it's
violent.
Best and worst, all it was.
Well, the film itself is just pure goodness, but it is a tragic story. Yeah.
But and I would also say that like this, I would recommend like anyone this film. Like as long as they like films, I would recommend them this.
Maybe if they don't like blood, it might be a bit much.
Yeah, but it's just an excellent film. And, you know, if you have, like, an issue with wrestling, you think it's stupid and fake, forget it and just watch this film anyway, because it's just great.
Or we'll fight you at WrestleMania in a tables, ladders and chairs match, and we'll see who comes out saying which films are good and which aren't. So I'm throwing the gauntlet down, but I think you guys should, you know, give some kind of goodbye. Maybe but with your favourite wrestler quote, if you wish. Just a thought. I'm going to go with... Woo!
I can't beat that one. actually, I can end it with an Ultimate Warrior quote.
Go on. Oh, what a noise. He did
a very,
much.
Very quiet...
Yeah.
Grandpa Terry. Go on.
I've got my quote. It's of Terry Funk. Again, I told you it the other day. And it's where he was holding like sort of like a baseball bat with barbed wire around it or something. And he just looked at someone and went, I'm someone's grandpa.
That's an apt note to finish on. Because that's just too good. Yeah. Bye.
Bye. Bye.